Our guest tonight is the inventor of one of the first digital reverberation systems. He considers himself the grandfather, not the father or the godfather, and helped start Lexicon, and started very early on with the fantasy of a portable concert hall, being able to bring reverberation into a space where it wasn't there before. Without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Barry Blesser.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. I have to tell you, the origin of this book and the presentation came about because over my 40-year career being an audio engineer, starting fields and companies, I just had the feeling I was missing something. That for all that I had learned, and I got pretty good, pretty lucky, it didn't quite fit together. I couldn't make sense out of it. And so I started what eventually became a re-looking at the old questions, but from a completely different viewpoint. And I put this slide up because few of us really look at the question of epistemology. In fact, some people don't even know what the word means, or philosophy. How do you know what you know? And what are the assumptions that support what you know? And you listen to the dialogue here and in every other professional group that I've been part of, and there's kind of this conviction that you know what you're talking about in terms of its foundation. As if you're a mathematician, you know that everything starts from axioms and you either assume parallel lines meet at infinity or they don't. But if you were to talk to this group and say, what are your assumptions? Or if I'm part of the speech and hearing research group studying audiology and other aspects of hearing, or neurophysics, and I say, what are your assumptions? Where are your axioms? Where's your philosophy of science? Most of the ones that are under the age of 30 don't even know what I'm talking about. So this book, and it was really my own personal adventure story. I wanted to answer the question for myself. And it became a book. And along the way, I came up with a lot of different perspectives that we don't ordinarily think about. From searching the literature. And one of them, which I'll share with you now, we can pick it up in the discussion, is called the perceptual uncertainty principle. And what that says is that if you run a scientific experiment, you have a choice, if you run a research investigation, you have a choice. Do you want it to be broadly applicable to the real world with real people, or do you want it to be reproducible? And reproducibility and applicability don't go together. And as a questioner with assumptions, you have to decide which is more important to you. And we can pick this up in the discussion later. The other surprise was that we are not rational, logical beings. We may have a piece of us as that. We all have agendas. This group, everybody in here has a personal agenda. But every intellectual group, every academic, scholarly group has their agendas. And they're not talked about, and as a newbie to your professional group, you're kind of indoctrinated, but you never really think about it. So starting with this background, by the way, this talk could go on for about 40 or 50 hours, so I've had to compress it a little bit.
Here's the compressed version.
This is a compressed version, and I can often run out of gas.
A little bit.
Compression algorithm.
Absolutely. I have to talk very, very fast. All right, one of them is the question of quality. Now, I have a sense of quality. Everybody in here has a sense of quality. If you listen to this discussion, everybody debated quality, good and bad. But if you ask yourself, where is quality come? What's the underlying pinning of it? And what's the dynamic of quality? Not for us in the 21st century talking about Cleveland Symphony Hall, but over the centuries, over cultures, across the broad spectrum of humanity in the great bigger picture, what is quality? And you don't come to the kind of conclusions that we all know should be true. And it's an interesting question, why isn't the world sense of quality match the historic perspective? I just threw up this slide here as an example of just a few snippets that I picked up. The Boston Symphony Hall, which we know is a great hall, was detested when it was first built. Everybody thought it was dreadful. Musicians, critics, listeners. It took like 4 or 5 years to come into its own, and there were all kinds of rationalization. When Gershwin performed in American in Paris, The critics called it nervous, claptrap, vulgar in a name, and the adjectives go on and on. Radio City Music Hall, which was considered the ultimate quality when it was built, took the position that acoustics is noise, and you want to get rid of every piece of acoustics you possibly could. This was quality in the 30s. There are good social reasons for this. When Shakespeare set up his Globe Theater, which they had now been studying and reproducing and resurrecting, it was designed on the base of copying the bear baiting arenas of the period. That's the acoustic model that he used. And ultimately, when you look over this long period, you find the sweet spot. How many people can experience a consistent positive, whatever positive means, listening experience is the sweet spot. And that varied from 25,000 to 1 over the cultural period that I looked at. That's a pretty high dynamic range. So across the bigger picture, you have to ask yourself, what's the cultural influence? What are the social values, which may be global social values or subcultures? Our whole experience by listening came about from an evolutionary trajectory which served other functions. We get into an interesting sensory subculture, which is this third line. We are how we live. It turns out that when you study this in detail, subgroups who live a particular way, let's say they listen to music, they're conductors, or they're blind, or they're really into paintings, their brain changes. Not just in the sense they learn to become more sensitive, but there's neurologic evidence that's now coming out that when you take these subgroups and you participate in some activity for hundreds of hours, thousands of hours, you don't have the same brain as you had before you started the activity. So the assumption that you are the same as you just because we're all people no longer is true. And so you have to then ask yourself, well, when I'm talking about some phenomenon of good and bad and quality, what's the subculture and whose brain am I referring to? Audio engineering and acoustics have a social component. Now, when you get into this question of sound, we think of, this group especially, will think about how the acoustics change the experience of music. So for this presumption, you're looking at the question, space changes sound, what attributes in space change the sound in what way? However, there's a flip side of it, which is we're all aware of, but we don't think about, and that is sound and space are bilateral. We get our experience of what the space is from listening, and just as sound changes space, space changes sound. It's not a unidirectional phenomenon. Okay, you can now go into the question of spatial awareness. We think of space by looking, but you can also say, well, we get a sense of a space by listening, by our ears. And in the end, I'll sort of jump to a broader definition of hearing. And these are just a few examples of spaces that have unique personalities. And if I brought you into one of these with your eyes closed, you could clearly recognize each one of them. The space is communicating to you by the acoustics, by what it does to the ambient sounds. You acquire a sense of the environment strictly by the acoustics. This is not the same as sort of the concert hall type of mentality. This just proves that you're aware of space. The next part of this discussion is it's very easy for an engineer or a scientist to think in physical terms. It's easy to think of first reflections, reverberation, time, sound absorptions, acoustics, but that's not what humans experience. That's the intermediary language that people with training will use. So your experience is not reverberation. You experience something else. You as a scientist can say, what I'm experiencing I call reverberation. It has these properties. I observe these things. But what is the human experience? It has a different language. Spatiality is what I'm calling the human experience of space by listening. But I'm not dragging myself and my readers back to the physical world of scientists and engineering and sonic measurements, because we don't live in that world. We may be trained to contribute to it, to manipulate it, but that's not the experience we have. Spaces change your emotions. They change your social relationships. We start asking, how do they change your emotions? You can't use the language of technical measurements. You get back into this, the perceptual uncertainty principle. If it's broadly applicable, if it's had a lot of applicability, it probably is not easy to measure. Although I just came across a study in Germany where they did an extensive examination of the classrooms in the German schools in terms of acoustics, but they used a very interesting measure, which is unusual. They measured heart rate and physiologic stress, where the physical measurements of the acoustics were only the intermediaries that the technical people dealt with. And what they found is there was a very significant measurable physiologic response to the spaces, which people might not even be able to articulate, but they were responding to the spaces. You get cultures, you get subcultures, you get microcultures, you get sub-microcultures, each of which is different. They don't experience the world in the same way. And even your concept of how many senses do you have, which we all say five, is culturally relative. There's a tribe whose name I can't remember. They have two senses. They have vision for the purpose of not bumping into trees, and they have experiencing life, which is everything else. And for us, we have the sense of touch, but actually it's three or four or five different senses. It's vibration, it's texture, it's all kinds of other attributes which we call touch. We've collapsed them. This is relative to your culture or subculture. How you interpret something as a human organism comes from your experiences. If everybody in this room has similar experiences and similar history, you're likely to experience it in a similar way. But if you came out of a different history with different experiences and trained your brain in different ways, you're not necessarily going to experience it the same way. It's hard to accept that this concept of quality is so elusive when you accept cultural relativism. You have a choice. You can say everybody is exactly like me, or people vary, and the variability, unlike many scientific experiments, is not noise. The variability is the essence of the story. And to throw out variability by averaging and making some sweeping generalization is to ignore the essential piece of this. Okay, now, just to hammer home that space and spatiality are not the same, I put up a visual version of what I'd love to have as an oral experience. This is, an Escher picture. And he's got space there. There clearly is space. There are staircases, there are doors, there are windows. You can't exist in that space. It has spatiality attributes, but it is not space. And for a hardcore scientist or architect, he would smile and say, that's not real. But from a human looking at it, you see spatial attributes. Now, think about what the oral equivalent would that would be. In fact, when you listen to recorded music, you're listening to an Escher picture. There is no space in 99.9% of all recorded music. There are attributes of spatiality, but you can't oralize a space because there never was a real space and it's too contradictory. Similarly with the concept of space, you can go to the flip side and say, okay, what is spacelessness? And here's your anechoic chamber. Many of you are old enough, probably you actually have had the opportunity to be in one. How many people have been in an anechoic chamber? Okay, so do you remember the first time you walked in? Okay, what you are suddenly being thrust into is spacelessness. There are more elements to it than that. And you didn't like it. There are people reporting they get nauseous. I forget the famous musician who, when he first time went into it, said, The thing that upset me the most is I could hear the blood moving through my body. You really don't like the sense of spacelessness. Now, since I don't have 64 hours and I can't compress this talk so fast, I'm going to jump to the overarching structure. In doing this research, I had to come up with the language of oral architecture, the language of spatiality, without reverting to the hardcore acoustic scientific audio engineering. And I came up with these five. Actually, the book has two of these merged together because even in the 4 months since the book has come out, the amount of dialogues I've had with people all over the world, I've started to learn a lot. There's a lot more to this story, and I hope it goes on. These are the five major concepts of spatiality. And remember, spatiality is the human experience of space by listening. Only one of which is what I call music spatiality. You can go down the list, and I'll illustrate them quickly, and then we can have some open discussion if you care. I know this group is particularly interested in musical spatiality. It's sort of a fringe in the larger picture. Okay, so you've got navigational. How do you move around the space by listening? Spiritual, it takes on special meanings from experiences. Actually, that should be symbolic. I made that mistake. Sorry. You get social spatiality. How does the environment you're in change your social relationships? You get musical, which we've all heard about. Aesthetic spatiality is just the pleasure of oral texture. And I'm sure there will be others to be discovered. In the next few minutes, I'm going to quickly give you a peek at each of these five, and then talk about some of the implications. And there are implications that come out of this, which also surprise me. Navigational spatiality. And this is the premise that without your eyes and without touching, you can in fact navigate some spaces with your ears, and with some training you can do very well. If any of you have read the book or seen the movie Ray Charles, you will remember there's this fragment where he says, I swore when I became blind I was never going to have any of the accoutrements of being blind. No cane, no seeing eye dog. And he doesn't talk about the fact that he navigated space using his ears. But he's part of a long tradition that did that. It's misnamed as echolocation. In fact, we, not being blind and not developing this ability, we can hear an open doorway, you can hear a wall. I used to do this experiment when I was at MIT. I'd take students and say, get a guinea pig and say, close your eyes, walk towards that wall, and stop when your nose is 6 inches from it before you buck into it. And everybody would laugh. And about 80% of the students could do it the first time. The rest could do it with a couple practices. You can hear a wall. So the notion that you can only hear sound sources is simply not true. You can hear what the space does to sound sources. And in fact, you can go further. You can say there is no such thing as a pure sound source. You and the source exist in a space. And that space always plays a role in the transport of the sound to your ears. And in fact, you can go further and say you don't actually hear sound. What you hear is an event, an action that took place in the world. And sound was the transport mechanism of communicating that event from the outside world to your head. Now that's a non-scientific way of saying how people experience it. Sound is an intermediary. And before the 20th century or the 19th century, there was no language of sound. And if you go back further, sound was very, very important, even if you couldn't describe it, because it's one of the few sensory means by which you can connect to what's taking place in the world outside you. You don't need light. You don't need the cooperation. It's very hard to block sound. Sound was a broadcasting technique that has been around for thousands of years, long before the 21st century or the 20th century. Okay, this is just to prove the point, and I've been called a fraud because nobody believes it. These are teenage kids in California that are blind. And as part of their self-esteem and as part of teaching them to navigate, there's this group out there, and they've been featured. There was a GBH program on this. I think it was GBH, but it was sort of public television. These kids are blind, and they're riding their bicycles entirely with their ears. And this tradition of using your ears goes back. It's been reported in the 17th century. Diderot reported it. It got very controversial. This is a whole segment of spatiality that really didn't come into its own until the 1950s in terms of being recognized. It was studied during that period because of the number of World War II veterans that came back with damaged vision. And the question was what to do with them. So like every era, what gets studied in the culture depends on what's hot. In the 40s and 50s, rehabilitation of veterans, unlike now, was a hot topic. And echolocation was a major point of discussion. All right, we can come back. I can come back to any of these things. Social spatiality, which is sort of my favorite, and my wife and co-author really made me understand the appreciation of that. And it's sort of a derivative of some work that was done earlier. We have the concept of a horizon, an acoustic horizon. How far can you hear? So our concept of space is not walls and is not vision. But if you think about a delineation of a region of the space within which you can hear events and beyond which you can't, that's an auditory boundary. That's an oral boundary which defines the spatial region just like vision does. I can't see beyond the wall, so that defines a boundary. But if that wall were black cloth and I could hear well beyond it, from an oral point of view, what's on the other side of the black cloth is well within my acoustic horizon. So you get two concepts, the acoustic arena and the acoustic horizon, depending on whether it's sound-centric or the perceiver-centric. And one of my favorite examples is the definition of citizenship in the 19th century French villages. The definition was not legal or even social. It was simply, if you could hear the bells in the center of town, you were part of the town. If you couldn't, you weren't. That this was the gluing communication mechanism by which town membership was created. The bells gave you the time of day. They told you when to come to church. They told you if there was an emergency. They were a signaling system. They were a broadcast network. And the town geography was determined by the hills and valleys in terms of how it passed along the sound from these bells. And when there was combat between two neighboring towns over trying to have more citizens, they would destroy each other's bells. So hearing was the glue that kept these people together, and I called it social cohesion. Just a few other examples of sociospatiality, where you, at a restaurant, you're sitting at a table, can you hear the person across from you? You can't have a social connection with architecture. It's really about matching the needs of the space to the needs of the people to the space. But without having a language for what their needs are, you can't go about doing that. The last one is also interesting, and I'll jump to that in a moment. If you think about connecting to people and events in your environment, and if you think about yourself as wearing headphones playing loud music, you're not in the space around you. You cannot hear anything that's going on around you. You can't hear the car driving into your blind spot. You can't hear any event. So from an oral point of view, you've been jettisoned into a hyperspace of your music. You are far, far away from an oral point of view. And in fact, I just recently read that New York, several cities in New York State, have passed laws, or about to, saying it's illegal to walk around the city with iPods, earbuds in your head, on wearing them, for one simple reason. The people were getting killed because they were in their musical space while they stepped into the street, and no car horn could break through. Every event in that environment was shut out. They were what I now call functionally deaf. So deafness doesn't mean you can't hear sound. Deafness means you can't hear what's going on in the environment you are. Yeah?
I would think that if people were sufficiently visually vigilant, that wouldn't be a problem, but obviously it is for some people.
Yeah.
I wanted to comment in particular, in addition, on the restaurant situation. I have experienced many New York restaurants where the audibility distance is about 9 to 10, 9 inches to a foot, because things are just roaring. I care for, when I go to New York, I try very hard to avoid those restaurants. I think I have a little bit weaker cocktail party effect than some of the people.
Well,
I can hear the flaws. It's a matter of my hearing style. I can hear, you know, modulation noise in a tape recorder, but I can't single a person out as well as a...
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting question. I've had a lot of debates recently, and I'm probably going to write some articles on it. There's a multifaceted aspect of it. The first hypothesis that was thrown at me is restaurants do this on purpose to drive you out so you don't sit at the table too long. Another thesis that's been put forward is that people like the frenetic intensity of being enmeshed in a loud space.
I've heard that. I've complained to a New York restaurateur who said there are many of my customers who, if it doesn't sound like that, they think nothing's happening here and they won't come.
The other argument is our culture has gone to both global connectedness and total isolation at the same time. using, you know, all the media, we're connected to everybody in the universe, but we're connected to nobody in the old sense of the natural human size for community was 150 to 500. And there's a lot of evidence that says historically, when the community got bigger than that, it split, and if it was too small, it merged. So if you take the position in the restaurant that actually communicating with the people at your table is a lost art, or in a cultural relative sense, undesirable, then the loud music serves a role. There's another, loud noise. I have another set of theses which says that loud music and all its cousins actually has a drug-like effect on your brain, and that there's a payoff system for putting yourself into this. I've got fragmentary evidence, and I would probably try to integrate it and come up with a paper. But rather than sitting there saying, no, don't have noisy acoustics, or don't play your music so loud, I think we'll find, I hope I'll find, or we will find, that in fact there's a positive system going on which we have not yet recognized, and there's a payoff. And unless you deal with the payoff, you can't get people to behave differently. So when the paper gets written, or if you'd like to contribute, a lot of this work I'm doing really becomes community activities. It's just not possible for one person to pull this kind of complexity together. So anybody who wants to contribute, they're welcome to throw me something.
I just want to throw this in. The noise that is deafening me in the restaurant is people talking.
Right.
Presumably someone is hearing those people, unless nobody's hearing and they don't
Well,
care.
Yes and no. For one thing, in a noisy restaurant, in order to maintain your socially comfortable distance, you'll obviously raise your volume. And so everybody then has to be talking. And this is well documented, that the feedback dynamic, everybody then ratchets up to the maximum level. You individually then have a choice to match that level, close the distance, or just wave at each other. So essentially it's an auction system. And the other part of this thing, which again historically, the sound space, the soundscape space is a commons resource. And whether it's humans or all the other species, it really gets auctioned off to the most powerful participants. And the notion of auctioning and oral combat, while we don't think of it as that, there's long traditions for that. And the technology just changes the nature of the combat. So while we may think of sound and oral experience as concert halls and music and this idealization, there's a very different historic precedent where music is only this fringe piece of the oral experience. Okay, we're only about 15 minutes into my 48 hours. So. This is just a quick slide showing the kind of parabolic mirrors you get at sort of the science museums where, you know, the mother goes to one and the kid goes to the other. And what I'm trying to illustrate here is while you may say that those two people are 50 yards apart visually, you can also say they're 2 inches apart orally. And the point of this slide is to say oral distance and visual distance are not necessarily the same. And measured distance has nothing to do with the experience. When you want to go someplace, you don't say that's 36 feet. You may say, I'll get there in a second. You get a sense of the energy required. So the notion that distance is only physical is a cultural artifact of scientific mentalities and concretization. Distance has traditionally been measured in other terms. Social distance, a cat measures the size of an opening by whether their head can get through. You measure the distance in terms of how long it'll take you to walk there. But the notion of meters and feet as the measure of distance doesn't do it justice. This is the social measures of distance. This guy named Edwin Hall who did this work in the 50s. And he's brilliant work. It's long since forgotten because it's no longer hip and cute. But it's a brilliant piece of work. And he's got distance broken up into different social sizes. And these are the metrics by which you then use acoustic measures. If you want to get an acoustic distance matched to a social distance, this is how you do it. You don't deal in feet. Okay, and this is one of my cute slides. It's a Hogarth picture of a musician in his living room practicing, and the lots of street noise out there, the windows open because it's summer, and he's objecting. And the point of this slide is he thinks he's in his space. The moment he opens his window, there's one space. Everybody is sharing that. And he doesn't like the idea that the street riffraff can get into his space with their noise or their sounds. And the point of this is, sound does not respect these boundaries. So this is a social connection of spaces which look like they're two spaces, but from an oral point of view, they're one. Here you have the Greek amphitheater, which I discuss in the book. And this is also a social connection, because the Greek theaters were often socio-political events where the royalty and the upper classes and the educated elite all went to these performances, which were a combination of entertainment, politics, sociology, and religion all thrown together. And these major events had one interesting property. There was one performance. There wasn't a subscription series that you could decide when you go. You either went or you didn't go. That was it. And so to house all these people to participate required a big space. And this was another form of broadcasting. And it may very well be our concepts of democracy arose from nature's acoustic geography of the Greek hillside, which happened to be warm weather, so they didn't need covering. And it happened to be these rolling hills, which were reasonably good choices for building the Greek amphitheaters. So you could say, in some sense, that nature, as an oral architect, randomly bequeathed different groups and cultures the ability to take advantage of that, and this was one of them. Okay, musical spatiality, which you all have talked about, and I want to take the position that your conclusions are only valid in one type of music from one socioeconomic period, under one set of conditions, and within that, if you ask yourself, what's your concept of quality, what you're really doing, and I take Boston Symphony as a perfect example, it's so well documented. Sabin, who is considered the father of acoustics, he was not an oral architect. He kind of understood what it would be, and he said, I'm not. My job is to take the mandate from the sponsors, and their mandate was to take the Gewandhaus in Leipzig and replicate it in Boston, because the Boston Symphony is going to play the same kind of repertoire, you know, romantic 19th century music as they did there. They liked it there, we're going to like it here, but I want you to design it to have 1,000 more people in it. So his job as a technician was to take all the social, musical, artistic specifications as givens. He was not allowed to mess with them, and to replicate it in Boston, which he did a great job. Now, if you then ask, where did this concert hall in Leipzig come from? Well, the original one was from the 1700s. It burned down, and so they replicated that. And you start tracing these oral traditions, and what you find absolutely consistently is they were never designed. And in almost every case, there was no oral architect. There were people who reacted to what they found. There were people who selected, tuned, adjusted. And I have a couple of theses as to why there were no oral architects. There was no language. And the human ability to describe and remember oral spatial experiences is weak. And so unlike vision, you didn't get the technical support for what is called cultural ratcheting, which is each generation building on the previous generation. You, if you've never heard a Greek amphitheater, you have no way of understanding what it sounds like. You can read a text description. It's very difficult, even with 21st century technology, to record it. So you can't pass that on to your children or the next generation. You can travel there and experience it. And so the oral experience is, from a biological point of view, both more difficult to deal with and at the same time more important. Musical, so I said, okay, let's take musical spatiality not from the purpose point of view of Beethoven and Bach. Let's look across the centuries. Let's especially look at modern music, and let's ask, what's the experience of the attributes of musical spatiality? And just in simple terms, reverberation has two primary purposes. It does what I call temporal spreading. It takes an isolated note with sharp starts and stops, and it smears it. It becomes an acoustic cavity that belongs to the instrument. So whereas you may think a clarinet has one acoustic resonator, there are really two, which I call a metaclarinet. There's the physical tube, and there's the acoustic space. Some musical instruments have multiple resonators. The fact that we don't think about the concert hall as being part of the instrument in terms of its major role is just because the concert hall is not portable, it's not adjustable, it's not playable. But from a pure musical point of view, it's part of the instrument. A clarinet on the beach is what I call a proto-clarinet, and a clarinet in symphony hall is a meta-clarinet, and depending on your space, you're actually changing the instrument. And musicians will tell you they adjust their playing style, the conductors, based on the space they're in. They're dealing with the fact that each space is part of the instrument. Now that's in temporal spreading, not spatial spreading. There's another whole part of reverberation, and that is the issue of localization. You go into Boston Symphony or a cathedral, and one of the properties about the reverberation in the spatial spreading sense, it comes from all over. And if you then think about what might that mean to humans, humans who evolved where sound localization was highly critical because you want to know where the animal was, what's going on. Localization was the most important part of sound, not listening to my lecture, but where am I? Reverberation can't be localized. So I ended up calling reverberation oral caffeine. It's sort of a stimulant just because it has no localization. The details of it, you know, the musical types can worry about, the acoustic types can worry about, but from a human experience, that's how I looked at it. Interestingly enough, and I'll get to this later, as a recording artist, as somebody who wants to reproduce the experience of music, you got an interesting philosophical problem because the performance environment contributes to temporal spreading, but the reproduction environment contributes to spatial spreading. You can't really record the spatial spreading. And whatever temporal spreading has been put in, you can't take out. So these two issues alone basically say there can be no single artist that controls the oral experience the moment you go to record it. And in a real live performance, all these issues get squished together when the group and the conductor chose the venue and so forth. Artistic space in the musical sense has a lot of contradictions, and I'll do one more. By the way, how long do I go before everybody falls asleep? Anybody sleeping now? Okay. You get spatial contradictions. When I did my first digital reverberation system in the 70s, I was indoctrinated with one central definition of quality. It should sound like a real space. It should sound like the Boston Symphony. It should sound like this. And my whole subculture was heavily into the issue of, was it a faithful replication? They didn't understand, I certainly didn't understand what the implications of that were. And so we evolved. 25 years later, you go into a design facility that's making an artificial spatial system, or you go into a recording studio, they're totally indifferent to whether it's a real space. They're perfectly happy to have the solo singer in a small intimate space and the background flutes in some large cathedral, and they're perfectly happy to change it at will. They're happy to have people move in the oral space. There's no purity because it's an artistic experience. It's a season to taste. And when you get to the electro-music type, even if you don't like their music, and I'm not gonna say you should or shouldn't like it, but what they're doing to the spatial dimensions shows you what the spatial dimensions are. The fact that you may want to exist on a certain point in those dimensions because you happen to like a certain kind of music, that's your prerogative. But you certainly can understand what the dimensions are. And well, this is just a quick view that without space, a clarinet can't play a chord. With space, it can. The elongation essentially gives you chord-like experience. I'm not a musician. And so this just basically, that's why space is part of these instruments. Okay. Musical space, the dimensions of musical space. I came up with four primary ones. I'm not a musician. Primary versus slave. And by this I mean, when you hear something and you hear something else, are those things created by the same person and one causes the other? And this is, for example, in reverberation, where you get a direct note and it causes the slave event, which is the reverberation. But if you think about a reverberation device, there's no reason why that actually has to be coupled to the primary note. You can have a direct sound, and you can have some other synthesized note-like thing going into the reverberation process. You can begin to change this relationship and the, whether it's primary or slave. In fact, you could play a music in the electroacoustic sense by just playing its reverberation. Okay, that's a musically legitimate concept to consider if you wanted to. Next, you get localized versus diffused, and we've already talked about that in reverberation. But from a musical point of view, you could be sitting right in the middle of a chorus. Okay, the experience of that chorus is completely diffused. On the other hand, you could be far away from the whole orchestra, and it's a point source. Your experience as to whether it's localized or diffused, whether it's reverberation or the performance themselves or some synthesized hybrid, is another artistic choice. And finally, you get to whether it's fused or decoupled. You could have multiple musical event-like things so fused they're perceived as a single element, or they can be pulled apart, decoupled. The composers call these musical layers. And space is just one of these elements in the musical process which can be manipulated in varying degrees along these three dimensions, and there are probably others. The fact that the 19th century Romantic musicians chose one set of answers for these questions is perfectly fine. I happen to like that music, but they're really working within this much larger space which I've represented here. Okay, here's some musical spaces, Boston Symphony, we know. Here's one that's one of my favorites. I've never been there. Stockhausen had this performance in the Yedid Caves in Lebanon, and there are various descriptions of it by various people who've been there. The human experience of being in these acoustic caves was like nothing else, and there are numerous personalized descriptions of it. And you begin to realize this music in Boston Symphony would not have had the same impact. Whether it's better or worse is a different question. Whether I personally like it or not is a different question. But clearly, there are multiple choices of space. And finally, you get to the Beast, which stands for something I can't remember in England. And this is entirely a synthesized space, as well as synthesized music. Why should spatiality require walls? Why should it require any physical anything? If it's an artistic season to taste, and if I have the technical means to create a spatiality experience as I see fit, then a surround group of speakers and the Osaka World Fair in 1970, there were numerous pavilions which had just this. Why not, if it's an artistic human experience? And so people experiment with it. And actually, I've been asked an interesting question. Do I like this kind of thing, or is this all these new freedoms isn't good? And I had to think about the answer to the question. And I came up with the really profound difference between the 21st century in the musical arts and previous centuries. It's not what they do, it's not the music, it's the time frame. If you look back at how long it took a composer to come up with a new musical form, or an instrument maker to come up with a new instrument, it often took years, decades, even generations to refine it. That the invention refinement process took a long time. Maybe trial and error, lots of dead ends, there's certainly museums of dead end instruments. A long tradition. If you jump to the 21st century, people are doing the same kind of thing. But the moment they come up with something, they drop it and move on to the next. So from my perspective, what's really changed is the refinement process has been so short-circuited that you really don't have time for humans to digest their own creation. And if you, this is my own personal judgment. This is not an intellectual target. Okay. Symbolic spatiality is where it acquires meaning from cultural exposure. It's linked to other senses. We get the concept of an earcon as a parallel to an icon, and I don't mean this in the computer sense. But you begin to associate certain spatial sounds with certain experiences, having certain meanings. I grabbed a few examples. Bells in these pre-Columbian Mexican tribes had some special meaning. It became symbolic. The Aeolian harps in ancient Greece were considered the wind bringing the music of the spheres to humans. And this was essentially a religious type of thing. My friend David Lubman has been studying the pyramids at Caucasian, and one of them sounds very much like a sacred bird, and the argument is whether this culture would have treated this physical structure as having the same attributes as their spiritual bird. and you get evidence from the 1450s.
You say sound, you mean like the wind blowing over it?
No, it's a particular set of staircases. It's a lot of work I've studied it. There are the recordings online. But basically, the particular, you get a diffraction grating kind of thing. And if you stand at the base of this pyramid, which has a bunch of steps at a certain interval, and clap your hands, you get a kind of chirp-like spectral spreading, which sounds like this bird. And so the question was whether this is an accident discovered by 21st century scientists, or whether the culture had discovered it, and this gave this particular structure its religious meaning. And there's a debate going on. I have a compromised position. You get evidence from the builders of the cathedrals in the 15th, 16th, 17th century that the oral experience of this enveloping massive reverberation became, it wasn't initially, became a kind of oral version of God's home. Space takes on meaning. This is one that's also been studied by Loveman. It's the shrine at the Chester Cathedral. And although you can't see it, if you walk in there and you start talking, it's like nothing else. And David Loveman recorded these, and it's really striking. You just feel like you've got this intimate relationship with God if he existed. And as you're in there talking, a combination of amplification, resonances, isolation from the outside world, all of this come together to give you an experience like this is a special place where you're going to pray. You can hear the samples online. I don't have them here. And this is just another example of a modern version of the acoustic clouds and this kind of spatial design taking on symbolic meaning. You get into aesthetic spatiality. I'm rushing because I know you guys are going to fall asleep. You may want to take pot shots at me. aesthetic spatiality basically says you like cultural variety. And I came up in the book with a hypothetical oral wallpaper. You get diversity. You get regions of your space, not like this, which have unique properties, little alcoves. You may choose to put absorption in one area and not in another. Just textual variety as opposed to consistent, uniform everything. I call that aesthetic spatiality. Here's an example which was not intended as aesthetic spatiality. This is a sculpture in the gardens of the Madrid Museum. And this particular stainless steel group of pipes was inadvertently discovered by a group of Spanish scientists that have very interesting oral properties because you get filtering and diffraction patterns, you get all kinds of oral experiences such as if you stood on one side, it changes your experience of the ambient. And they studied this and confirmed, sure enough, it was true. The curious thing is it was not designed for this. And, Semper was a visual artist and he'd not intended it for it. And this actually is the modern version of the pattern that you get all through the culture and ages, that people don't intentionally design their oral experiences. They evaluate things they stumble into, they decide what they like, they accentuate, they adjust, they modify, they tweak. But you don't get the parallel to the visual architects who'll sit down with a pad of paper and scribble something. There's a kind of trial and error and a kind of, to go back to the earlier slide, once you become familiar with something, you like it. And that's the consistency. And I'll just do one more digression. I'm getting actually towards the end. In the late 1960s, all of this wine importers in Great Britain conspired to take French wine and dilute it with 50% Algerian junk wine. And they did this for years. And they sold it as high-priced French wine. And eventually they were caught. They were all shut down. And good quality French wine could now finally come into Britain. What was the first reaction? Yeah. What did you do to our quality French wine? Why did you give us this junk that is not like we're used to? It was the same reaction as Boston Symphony. So if you accept the premise that cultures don't like change, people don't like change, then the concept of quality begins to ooze away from you. Just like in the 1930s, I don't know if I have that slide here, I guess I don't. 1930s, the Rockefeller Center was designed with the premise that every piece of acoustic should be shot and killed until the space is absolutely as pure dead. as possible.
Just like Studio 8H?
Studio 8H. And there's a long discussion in the book about Studio 8H, Rockefeller Center, and there's a cultural reason why. And this was the definition of quality, unchallengeable, until the 50s, when a group of pop musicians decided to do a recording in one of the abandoned ballrooms in one of the hotels. I can't remember my age, I got the excuse, I don't remember a lot of this stuff, so I gotta read my own book. And they discovered they liked the effect. And so they brought acoustics back in the popular music genre, and then eventually they began to realize that you couldn't take 19th century music, even Toscanini couldn't, and make it sound decent in Studio 8H, because it was designed for a particular space. So if you say the space is perfect, what you're really saying, it's perfect for a certain class of listener, for a certain musical tradition from a certain period, because it's replicating what they had refined. It's not an abstract perfect. Okay. We've already alluded to functional deafness. I'm not going to drown you in it here. This slide was from talks where people don't have a lot of background in sound, but it's worth considering. Sound is time and sequence, flows around obstacles. Key point, you have no earlids. And if you think about the fact that you have no earlids, that tells you something about sound. It tells you that nature decided it was too dangerous to give you control over what you heard. Your ears are on 24/7. And if you then follow the implications of that, you realize sound becomes a very profound sensory experience, which we've lost our appreciation for. Sound reveals the interior states of objects, whether you tap on this or you listen to an elephant roar in terms of his emotional life. You learn an awful lot about what's inside things that you can't see from sound. The environment changes the experience, or we already been there. And then I come to my favorite slide, which I don't have to do here. Don't blow your ears out, because you can't realize what it's like to be deaf. And that goes back to that earlier discussion. So I'll skip this for the moment, I'll give you a chance. And finally, we're all oral architects, because nobody owns this profession. It's too diffuse, and you can't have a single owner. So I guess I've gone for about, I don't know, however long. You guys can take shots at me.